Welcome, everybody, again to the Doom Optimism podcast. I have my trusty sidekick with me, Ashley Fitzgerald. Why is Colby there? Why
I know. I can't
would you be
like just
interacting with
stick
that?
with it. I need to just pick one and go with it.
You
I keep
do.
flip-flopping. I know.
Yes. And we are very fortunate to have a special guest that we've had on before, Veron Morgan. Hi, Veron. How are you doing?
Hey, well, how are y'all doing? It's good to
Good.
see you. Good,
Yeah.
good. Good to have you here.
You've been up to a lot since the last time we talked. So the last time we talked about kind of growing up in Appalachia and kind of Appalachian culture. And I think we talked a little bit about that. You're a journalist. You tell stories. You like to get into the human element of stories. You can introduce yourself a little bit. I think our audience might know you, but if you want to do a quick introduction and then maybe just right off the bat, what stories are really gripping you right now that you're reporting on.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. My name's Farron. I'm
If I pronounced
from.
it wrong, I apologize.
That's
Farron, no problem.
okay. I take the licks as they come. I grew up in Appalachian, Virginia. And also Eastern Kentucky. My family's roots are in Eastern Kentucky. I do write. I kind of bristle at journalists just because I feel like what I do is so different than that and almost not deserving of the title, but I am a contributing writer at County Highway, which is a national print only publication that treats all of America like a small town. And that's really been fulfilling. I love being there. I love my editors and the editorial process. It's just been wonderful for me. I've had the opportunity to work on a few stories. One, I think we talked about last time I was with you, which was a story I was working on about wildcrafting in Appalachia. I wrote another. My editor calls them sweet stories, but a sweet story in this case, literally and figuratively, about sorghum molasses and the production of sorghum molasses in Appalachia. That was really about my family, but they all are in some way. And most recently, I reported a story about a proposed lithium project in Gaston County, North Carolina, in the Piedmont region. And really, my goal in writing that and writing all the stories that I've reported is to really elevate human voices and human stories. I think it's so easy when we're consuming digital news and news is being reported on digital platforms for things to sort of get bleached out and for it to just be sort of a regurgitation of facts. My personal goal, and I truly hope that I accomplish this, I'm working toward accomplishing this, is making sure that the stories that matter, and to me, those are the stories that originate in the communities, get told. And that those voices are as important as any other governmental, political, corporate, et cetera, voices. That's what I've been up to.
Yeah, that's good. I'll also jump in and just say, Farron and I got to meet in Wyoming a few months ago, and it was just so good to meet in person. Like the County Highway is a nice publication that kind of has brought together a lot of people circling around our little Doomer Optimism sphere and adjacent spheres. And I would say it'd be interesting to hear what you think of, we talked a little bit about this before we started, but what you think of as like the through line in a lot of your interests and a lot of your reporting. And then I guess we can kind of riff on that, between Jason and I.
Yeah, I thank you so much. And I loved meeting you. And also, Wyoming was a magical place. I'd never seen an antelope before. I wasn't even sure they were a real thing.
Yeah, that was it was a really cool event. Like just a lot of people who I felt like were just so open-hearted and also like normal in the sense of like not trying to be cooler than anyone else, not trying to be like in a political tribe, but just sort of like weird in themselves in a way and like tolerant of one another. I thought it was really nice. It was a nice
Yeah,
event.
I mean, honestly, I think loving people were just so even people who disagreed tremendously and are coming from almost totally opposite places found ways to come together, and care about each other and express care for each other.
Yeah, that was nice.
That was wonderful. That's what I took from it anyway.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, a couple of through lines. The main one really is sort of, my experience, frankly. It's my reporting's very subjective. A lot of it has to do, again, with just people and land. I mean, that's what it is, love in the earth, I say. But I think, looking towards sort of more political or sort of broader public trends, I think the biggest through line is just this sort of like financialization of the economy and this sort of position that we've almost not chosen but just accepted that if there is money to be made, that it should be made no matter what the other circumstances are, no matter what the community wants, no matter what the community's culture is, and no matter what's being lost by taking that position or taking that route. I really, I saw that in the lithium story. There's a term that's developed in kind of new energy parlance, which is social license. There's this notion that people automatically accept new energy or quote unquote clean energy development because of sort of broader public arguments and narratives that have been widely accepted. And in fact, there's this kind of like hesitance or almost opposition to the term "not in my backyard," but ultimately, people do not want 500 foot pit mines in their backyard. And my view of that is if you live in a community, you look around, you see your neighbors, you see what your neighbors have produced, and you care about each other, that's a fine position to take.
Yeah.
It's actually cool to say, you know what? No, thank you. And it's been interesting to see too how different community, governing bodies have responded to that. I think in North Carolina, it's interesting to see how the local board of administrators, board of commissioners, they really that matters to them. What their neighbors think really matters to them. But I've been in other places and other positions where, those bodies do not care at all, and they make the decision, they move forward, and they don't really want to hear about it. So, I think really just those human voices are really important, and elevating those human stories are really important.
I want to ask, talking about, the financialization of the economy, do you see this happening in a fundamentally new way? I know in Appalachia, like people, there's
Yeah.
been a lot of extractive kinds of economic activity for a long time, the logging industry, the coal industry, et cetera. Do you see this now, the way that it's occurring is fundamentally different in some way?
I see it as a accelerated. It seems like a lot of things are happening at once, and I think a lot of this does have to do with culture. So in Appalachia, there is a strong cultural connection to coal mining, and a lot of that has to do, and we talked about this before, Jason, to I think the connection that people have in their families. If they had relatives who were mining coal, if they had people who were able to make a living or earn a living mining coal, they feel, very strongly connected to that. That actually was interesting to see, kind of in contrast with North Carolina, where there is some history of lithium extraction in that area. And in fact, there's a band called the 25-mile band called the Carolina Tin Spodumene Belt, where there is a massive spodumene deposit, but the culture there is it's agricultural. People farm. People have strong connections to the land. They are not used to landmen. They're not used to people sort of bullying them into sales. They're not used to this sort of like, all of the sort of ugly social bits that come along with mining. And I think in Appalachia for a long time, we've almost taken those as a given. And in some ways, maybe even internalize those. I do think, though, in some of these, in some of these instances, we've talked a little bit about casinos before. I mean, that is a, there's no salary being earned. It's a direct financial exchange. So, what is being traded is the allure that one might win. So, it's almost the sell of possibility, and without there being any certain realization. And you know, to me, that is different. It's almost like we're not even trying to hide exploitation anymore. We're like, let's just do this. There's money to be made. It doesn't matter where it comes from. Let's go for it. So I think, you know, I think those are kind of two fundamental differences, but I do think that that's what it's rooted in. You know, where these traditions of extractive economies exist, I think they'll continue to exist.
I want to stick on the doom for a little bit longer. I love to make these podcasts like doom first and then optimism in the second half. So I was thinking maybe you could walk us through a little bit the lithium story. I know you and I talked a bit in Wyoming about this kind of like cognitive dissonance that exists between like clean energy as a theoretical concept versus like a literal mine in your backyard, which is the actual environment like behind your house, versus like the theoretical environment of like the climate broadly. And so, yeah, like just walk us through like who are the actors involved? What are people thinking on the ground? You know, did you experience, see, you know, did you see this cognitive dissonance? Like, just walk us through this story a bit.
Yeah, I'll start with the cognitive dissonance bit. Yes. Yes. I think you know, so sort of the in very broad strokes, the fundamentals of the story are there's this community in Gaston County, North Carolina, where a company that's now called Piedmont Lithium, that had its roots as an Australian company, has patched together this sort of massive land holding in order to extract and process lithium. Their intent is to build, actually, I think it's four pit mines, and to mine them, not all together, but to successively mine them. A big issue locally is the water table. The water table in that part of the country, in that part of the world, very close to the surface, and people have mine water, they have well water. So, you know, that's sort of a fundamental concern beyond all of the other environmental concerns. It is a pit mine, so it's a massive open pit in the earth. It's mining like any other kind of mining. They basically bore holes into the side of the pit, stuff them with dynamite, blast, extract, you know, the minerals that they want to extract, sell the minerals that they're not using to other entities. Their plan was to travel to move you know minerals to the processing plant on a covered conveyor belt to sort of cut down on trucks coming in and out, so on and so forth, and to quote unquote cut emissions. It's meant to be a very clean operation. The community itself, to give you a sense of what it's like, it is farmland and there is a lot of farmland, but it's also neighborhoods. It's like, you know, it's this is a place that's like 45 minutes outside of Charlotte. And, you know, no, it doesn't have the concentration of people that Charlotte has, but compared to a lot of rural places, it does have a concentration of households. Something that was interesting to me about it, and I think really psychologically just upsetting the people who live there, is that, you know, for the land holdings that Piedmont has sort of acquired and the single family homes that it's acquired, it developed a partnership with local fire departments to use those homes as basically fire training. So without notice to the community, they burnt homes. So folks were just sort of like, you know, driving down the road,
And there's a
watch.
house on fire.
There's a house on fire. Yeah. And to them, because, you know, at that point they still knew so little about the project, it felt like an intimidation tactic to, you know, to convince them to sell, to convince them that there was a certain inevitability about all of this stuff. And you know, to convince them to kind of get out of the way. The interesting sort of political aspect of this thing is that Piedmont focused most of its early efforts on investors and communicating with investors and also prospective customers. Tesla, you know, ended up signing a contract with Piedmont. All of that happened before Piedmont ever went before the local board of commissioners. So basically, all of these folks in this community are reaching out, to their board members, saying, "Hey, what the hell is happening? Like, what are these people doing?" And of course, just via land men and via sort of pressure campaigns to sell and chit chat among neighbors, they sort of got a sense of what was being planned, but not sort of scope, scale, process, timeline, et cetera. At that point, Piedmont also hadn't applied for its state mining permit. So it essentially, it dialed up all these investors, it dialed up, started trying to dial up a customer base, did in fact secure a contract with Tesla, before it sort of started doing the hard work of convincing people in the community and the state that this would be a good thing. My opinion of that is that they assume that there was so much money involved that of course they wouldn't be turned down. Of course it would be welcomed in the community. I think what they didn't anticipate is the strength of the grassroots movement that rose up in opposition. That to me was absolutely fascinating and really why I wanted to write the story, because I think, there's so many cases where people maybe they don't want something or they, even actively oppose it, but they just feel powerless against it. In this case, I felt honestly inspired by these people because
Good.
they're so disparate, so different, different kinds of people, different political backgrounds. Some of them, had their families had owned land for 200 plus years in the county. Other people, have lived there for 10 years, and it's their, their dream retirement community. But to see those people sort of come together, again, I'm skipping ahead on optimism, but that was really optimistic part of the story. I think, and I'm jumping around like crazy, but I do think that there's this, when we talk about green energy and we talk about sort of like battling climate change with green energy, it's really just sort of like almost its own language. It's empty, and people, people talk about greenwashing. Really, I feel like the whole way of communicating was greenwashing, because again, ultimately, like, you do not get energy from nothing. It does not appear from nothing. And so, this notion that like out of sight, out of mind, is really damaging to communities. And I think, ultimately, it's going to be, as we learn more about these sort of like quote unquote green energy technologies, it's going to irreparably damage trust. Because again, like, and this is, it's interesting with coal because it's a known quantity. But, when people first started mining coal, they weren't like, "Oh, great, let's like really like mess shit up." Nobody thought that at the beginning. And so, there is this sense that like, okay, why are you selling the dream before we have a solid sense of what this is? That's really sort of, that's my take. And again, like, it feels very almost make believe to read about these things online. And actually, my friend Bud brought me this story, and I, we talked on the phone about it. I was really excited to get out to North Carolina, really excited and interested to talk to people. And I got there and I was like, "Oh shit, these people, these are real humans." This is not like an abstract story. And I know that sounds absurd, but like, when you're face to face with somebody who is almost crying because he thinks he's going to lose his family's income, he thinks he's going to lose the basically his American dream, it's very different. It's very different than like, "Oh, well, like these things are going to happen, and some people are going to have to struggle, but it's for the greater good." It does not feel that way. It feels, it feels very personal. It feels very emotional, and it is. It's their lives.
I have a quick comment, and then I want to toss it to Jason for his question. But the one thing that really upsets me about a lot of this green energy stuff, and of course I pick on green energy because it pretends that it's good, but there's plenty of like industrial extractivism that doesn't even pretend to be good, that's just doing this bad stuff. So I just want to caveat that. But Green energy in particular, we're supposed to sort of sign on based on these like expert level assumptions, but you're not like allowed to ever check into those assumptions. And there's no real way to. And like one example of this that I know in some depth from my current research position is carbon markets. And the only re way I ever like found out that the assumptions underlying the existence of the carbon market, that you're storing carbon in soil, is going to talk to an actual like tenured soil scientist. And he's like, this is all bullshit. But the only way I knew this was like, he was like, there is just no way the claims that they're making are lined up with the soil science. And I am a soil scientist among a very small handful of experts who know this stuff in depth enough to debunk it. And yet all down the chain and all across, you know, journalism and all across regular people and farmers who just get like kind of bombarded with these expert level opinions that you are not allowed to question. It really, it's like there's a total power differential that comes in this, like, in the form of knowledge that's like, you know, we sort of know better than you. We know better that this pit mine's good for you and it's good for everybody because lithium's going to Elon Musk and Elon Musk is saving the world. And like it just goes straight up to like this expert level power dynamic, like extractivism.
I think that's such a good point. And what's interesting about it too is that, you know, that sort of expert research and you know, expert scholarship is one side of it. And then the other side of it is just like rando people. Because it's like one of the things that's so funny to me, or was funny to me in the story, was this notion that nobody's water level would be affected, that nobody would lose water. That, you know, nobody would have to worry about water contamination, that everything, you know, all sort of like testing, all stop gaps that are in place to prevent contamination or to prevent leaching would always work. But, you know, really fundamentally that people who are very close to this thing wouldn't lose water. If you've ever had well water, you know that what your ne next door neighbor who lives in like a family of four does with their water can affect your water. So if you're pumping millions of gallons daily, you know, into this pit mine, which is the plan. I mean, that's their stated plan. You know, that was in their in the application that they filed with the with the North Carolina DEQ. Then it's absurd to think that you won't be affected by it. Like, there's just this fantasy that people are meant to buy into, even though what they're experiencing in their lives and what their experience has told them over generations says otherwise. And, you know, that part of it too can feel so frustrating because the reporting is often, well, this is what the company said and this is what the experts say. And I'm like, well, what does Bob say? Like,
Somebody
why?
who's been living off well water this whole life and kind of knows that these systems are interconnected. Yeah, that's the other thing too. Like the farmers I've talked to are like, you know, on the concept of carbon markets are just like, you know, like I know that if I till up the soil, all that stuff is goes back up into the atmosphere. Like anything that is living in the soil gets killed in that process. I'm aware of that. Like, I don't need to know soil science to know that that is like the case. So it's not only like high level experts who can debunk it on the science, but just like, you know, there's kinds of knowing among regular people that just don't get.
Yeah, exactly. And there's you know, I think one of the guys I talked to, Brian Harper, he talked about this a lot. He's like, you know, whose perspective are we really taking into account when we're deciding which facts are valid? Because, you know, for us, we understand that like we're using well water not just for sort of personal household use, but for agricultural use. So when we talk about losing water, we're also talking about losing crops. We're talking about losing.
Industry,
Yeah,
jobs,
exactly. Which, you know, to somebody in who's lived in and no shade, I mean, this is a fine this is a fine way to live if you choose this, but for somebody who's lived in a condominium or a tiny apartment who loses water and, you know, can go next door to the Holiday Inn and take a shower, go to the gym and take a shower and somebody will come and magically restore water service. It's a very, very different perspective and a very different understanding of what that loss means.
This might be a difficult question to answer. It might be kind of one of the writing questions of this podcast. So, I mean, you mentioned earlier, energy is not free. It seems to be difficult to get energy without some kind of harm done to the earth or people, who live on top of it, usually. And historically, the people who have lived on top of it didn't have much voice in society, were pretty poor, continues to this day globally, United States and globally. And so I guess the question is, do we want energy? That's an absurd question. Is energy good? We rely on it to survive. So, like, what do we do, right? If we're if mining lithium is ruining the water supply and creating a group of people who are the victims of this, so then do we not pursue that energy? Like, do we just need to all use a lot less energy and minimize the damage? Or is there a way maybe that this company or these investors could have approached this in a way that was equitable and fair and and in the best interests of the people living there? Or is it just or as a society, if we decide, yes, we want energy, there's this much energy we want, do we just have to accept that there's going to be victims, right, in this process, and that's just the cost of doing business? I don't know if that's a weird question or
That's an insanely hard question to answer, but Farron will take it on. I believe in her.
Yes.
I
We've been
don't
waiting for you to come on to sort this
to solve this problem for all of humanity.
I was gonna say, I don't think we will solve this problem tonight, but
We'll try.
I mean, I do, around sort of the edges of the question, I do have kind of actually quite strong opinions, and I think, at the core, I do believe companies have a responsibility to get buy-in from the community and to bring the community along with whatever project that they're pursuing. And, I think ultimately Piedmont's approach of leaving the community out and turning to the community only at last resort, severely alienated people. And, I think these are really complex projects with a lot of moving parts. And I think, even sort of state mining applications, you really these are projects that you need experts to explain to you. And, by the time that lithium approached the community, no one believed their experts. No one believes them at all now. So, the community is angry, and I think justifiably so, and upset and fearful. And because they feel that they've been left out, misled, and in some cases outright lied to, they don't trust any self-monitoring that Piedmont might do. And that becomes the fundamental issue because, well, self-monitoring that Piedmont will be a domestically owned entity, that they're not sort of like building this up to sell, that they have, or certainly now they don't have, but will have adequate financing to pursue the project to completion. There are all these sort of like big questions that affect community health that they just have zero trust in Piedmont to answer truthfully. I do think, and I actually spoke off the record to a friend of mine who's a mining engineer, and that was really his perspective too. His perspective was, I love mining. Minerals slash mining are really important to your point, Jason, for sort of like human flourishing and thriving. These can be really good things. No, everybody won't always be happy, but there is a way to make most people happy. And that I don't believe was done in this case. I also think that pursuing this kind of project in a highly populated residential area is tough. And it's interesting because there are these communities, and Gaston County is one of them, where there is a legacy of mining. and of extraction, but not at the level or the rate that these companies plan to extract it. And so, you know, the size of the project, the scope of the project, which you know, some might say is necessary, others might say is basically a cash grab in an emerging market. I think that matters too. So, you know, I really think that, you know, do I think that we should just cut off all mining operations and never pursue sort of any cleaner energy technology? No, I don't think that. But I do think that we you know, we're kind of voracious. We have big appetites, and you know, these are not companies that are excited about a green energy future. These are companies that are excited about making money for investors. And you know, there's a tension between those two goals, I think. And that, you know, that makes things very difficult.
Jason, you and I haven't checked in for a while on this question. What's your answer? Is energy good?
I mean, energy is the fundamentals of life, so there's that.
Yeah, right. But do you have an updated stance at all on like a clean energy future? Have you thought about this in any more depth to previous discussions?
It's a very difficult question. I think we're gonna have to we're not gonna have a choice, I think, in the next, say, several decades of, we're gonna have to learn to live with less energy, I think. I did find it interesting that, I was watching a documentary series on Appalachia, or somebody who was just visiting Appalachia, and he was talking to a miner, and he was saying, a coal miner, and he was saying, business is great these days. And he's like, oh, why is that? It's like, oh, because of the electric cars, right? And they're all hooking up to the grid, and there's no other way that we can meet grid demand except for more coal,
Cool.
right? And so he was like, I would never buy an electric car, but I'm glad that they're there because they're, putting us back in business. I just think that a lot of environmentalists and proponents of green energy, they haven't really wrapped their minds around the fact that I don't think we can replicate what we did with coal and oil with metals, the metals energy economy, which is, the wind turbines and solar panels and things of that nature, which require, lithium, and they require cobalt and copper and all of these things, which have a huge environmental footprint and are often extracted, in places where people live and, and are those people are often exploited. I don't think a lot of, say the NPR progressive green energy economy set has really wrapped their mind around if we're really going to do what you say and, move towards a sustainable future, you're going to have to change your lifestyle, your kind of, yuppie lifestyle that, you're very comfortable, and you're not just going to buy your electric car, with money that really only you and your class can afford. And do that, right? There's going to be have to be some hard reckonings with that, and then me, I think we are going to be moving into more of a neo-agrarian future, but I don't know what that's going to look like. Won't include modern technology, but I think we're going to have to come to terms with the fact that, energy and food production is very tightly linked, and if we have less energy, just that we can get access to. We're going to have to, more people are going to have to get involved with food production. And we're going to have to relearn a lot of these old skills that we've lost. So I don't know,
Yeah.
different point of view than I've
No,
had.
that's good. No, I think that's good. I think the only thing I'll add, even though nobody asked, is one thing I've been on about lately is kind of like, I'm just wrapping my head around like what constitutes innovation in our society. And it's like, I think this is another one of those expert class things. Like you're supposed to be like, oh, I started a startup. Like I'm so amazing and so smart. I must be a genius. And then you're just kind of look at like the whole startup culture, and it's like you made some aquaponics vertical agriculture thing that had huge energy inputs and failed immediately and had no profits. Like, why am I supposed to be impressed by this? Like, so I think like a lot of the innovation is just really stupid, super hyper tech blind, like energy blind, Like just leaning into whatever new shiny thing exists. And so I've been thinking a lot about like bringing back old but very impactful or high quality of life technologies from the past, where we didn't have a ton of energy, but we still had like tons of human flourishing. And then that in combination with like so many things we've invented since the Industrial Revolution, like the bicycle is an amazing invention, just energy wise, like how much you can move for how little input. Just tons of things like that, like rocket stoves, and like I had a solar water heater in Uruguay, which is like there's nothing high tech about it. It's literally just black tubes that absorb the sun and then that warms the water up. Like so many things like that just never got commercial viability because it's not like this whiz bang high tech thing. And so I've just been thinking about that more and more. Like there's so many things out there energy wise that could totally have a super increased quality of life and don't have to be like terribly extractive and just destroy total communities. And like Elon Musk saying we'll coup who we want to coup to get lithium, like we don't have to choose that. That's not like the only thing that's not the only vision that exists in the future for like a flourishing society. There's no question there, but do you have thoughts, Baron?
Yeah, we've just been ranting for like
Yeah, no, we've just been
no, I
ranting.
mean, that's literally all I do, and I have no clue what I'm talking about.
That's okay.
No, I think what I'm thinking about is, and I think we talked about this before, Jason, is basically junk core, or what they call junk core now, which is, basically just people holding on to things because they might need them later and finding, a use that might be a non-traditional use. My maternal grandfather plowed with a mule because he could not afford a tractor. My paternal grandfather, who was a welder, made a tractor. And I think there actually is a name for these. One of the old timers told me the name, but I can't remember exactly what it is. I'm so sad about it. But he made a tractor out of old car parts that his son salvaged. He worked for the railroad and they transported salvage. So he would bring him, bits and pieces of old cars. And he literally made a working tractor that still works today that you can still, work with today.
Nice.
So I think the issue with innovation is that we don't really have necessity. We, again, it's like it's kind of the end goal is profit, but if you do come to a place where need is the reason, or sort of necessity is the reason, I think then you have sort of true, functional innovation that can come from crazy, crazy places. And I mean, another thing that I think about all the time, and I know that people who come from my region know this, or a lot of the old people do. I'm not sure that young people do, but a lot of miners had personal mines because they couldn't afford coal. So they're mining coal, coming home, might have a deposit, find their deposit, I mean, they might be like blasting, sort of using whatever methods they learned at the mine or were using at the mine. There are old pictures of dogs hauling coal out of personal mines, of goats hauling coal out of personal mines. And again, it's just one of these things where it's like, all right, well, this is what I need and this is what I have. So, I'm very proud of that part of who we are. But again, like these are ideas that are, I think super often lost because they might arise in a family that uses whatever the product is and never speaks of it to anybody. So it becomes this kind of like, kind of family legend type thing.
I love it. I was just thinking of two other examples. Jason and I had on this pretty interesting guy, Alexis from Living Energy Farm, and he had this whole like solar energy system on DC power, and he was like, it's got to be DC power, and like there's all these different ways you can get these appliances on DC power, and he's like, this is just the best and like most efficient way to use this. And I'm like, it's just amazing that there are people out there who are like just like grinding, innovating, like out of the goodness of their own hearts. And I think you're right, like necessity will force some of that. Another example is there's a, you know, a couple of examples of this on Twitter, but I met a guy recently, Jared Woodcock, who lives in upstate New York and does basically timber logging with draft horses. And just like, I don't know why. I didn't ask him how he got into it, but the first thing he said to me was like, you know, it's just like, it's just so hard to be a peasant in America. I was like, yeah, no, totally. I was like, we're best friends just now. After that one sentence, the first thing he said to me. And he was like, you know, I kind of grew up like in the woods, like as a peasant. And now it's like harder and harder, but like, I'm just going to do this and, you know, like make a living from it. And I don't know. I just feel like there's a lot of, we're clean in the optimism now, but you know, there's a lot of cool stuff out there like that. I did want to go back briefly to the lithium story and ask a little bit more about like the grassroots movement, the types of people involved, and just kind of like what they did and how it worked.
And where things stand now, is the Piedmont like still there? Like, is it like right in the middle of this battle going on?
So actually, there was news on this over the last couple of days. State regulators did issue a mining permit. So the barrier, the remaining barriers are basically financial and local. The local board of commissioners, the Gaston County Board of Commissioners, they told Piedmont after Piedmont neglected to come to them and read them in to their plans that they would not consider issuing a zoning variance until after the state had issued a mining permit. So the county has yet to issue a zoning variance. What they've said most recently is that they will not consider the zoning variance until July based on their annual budgeting schedule. So right now the project is sort of in this, you know, limbo. And to me, it's really fascinating. This is maybe the most fascinating part of this because as of yet, at least in you know, Farron world, which is pretty limited, so I'm not gonna say it's never happened. But I've really not seen a, you know, county board push back against this kind of project. It's usually so much money. And you know, they, especially in rural counties, Gaston County, because of their proximity, or in part because of their proximity to Charlotte, I don't ha think has, for instance, the budgeting constraints or budgeting challenges that folks in my neck of the woods have. But still, you know, if you're talking about millions and you know, millions of dollars of tax revenue in a pretty limited time frame, you know, these folks are politicians and they want to get credit for bringing that in and for whatever quote unquote public good that it does. I'm not saying it can't do public good. I'm saying that there's a balance between sort of like the harm that's being done and the good that's promised. But you know, in this case, I think it will be really interesting. I do think again, you know, board members have really intimate relationships with people in the community and they understand their positions well and you know, Chad Brown, who's the chairman of the board, told me, and it's something that I quoted in my piece, that he did not feel that Piedmont had been good neighbors. And this is the part of, you know, it's a part of the world where people take being a good neighbor very seriously. They really consider that, you know, they consider it a biblical mandate. So, I think it'll be, I think this part of the process and how it plays out will be really interesting. To turn to who the folks in the opposition are. They have a group called Stop Piedmont Lithium. And you know, in my view, it's a pretty sophisticated group. I mean, I got the sense, and I never ask anybody this outright, but they had so many of the same sort of talking points when they were sort of giving talking points rather than kind of their personal experience that I suspect that there was, you know, some regular communications planning going on.
Nice.
What they have that I think, you know, one asset that they have that I think has been really invaluable is that there is a guy who's involved and sort of, you know, fundamental to their effort who whose career is in basically corporate land development. And so, you know, he has this understanding of those processes and tactics that might be used, and you know, understands the permitting process, understands regulatory barriers and so on in such a way that, you know, he can sort of utilize those to his advantage and to the group's advantage. The folks themselves are honestly sweethearts. They're, you know, it's lots of older people. There's a guy, I think I mentioned Brian Harper. He's a machinist, and you know, he's very concerned. He's really the only person in this in the organization who is directly whose business is directly threatened by, or you know, potentially directly threatened by Piedmont's activities. His machining process can't really tolerate any level of vibration. The business is on the land. It's on his family land, basically. You know, he owns a house. He's got his machine shop, you know, a few acres away. He walks to work. You know, he's got everything right there. And it really, when I say it's his American dream, it's his American dream. I mean, this is not sort of the type of thing where it's like, okay, well, you know, I'll get over it. You know, I'll be able to do XYZ. Like, this is what he wished for himself. And I do think that, you know, I think a lot of sort of corporate executive types have a difficult time understanding that, because again, their goal is to make money. It's not to, you know, have a cup of coffee and go out on the porch and sort of, you know, watch deer play in the yard, or to have, you know, like four generations of your family on the same tract of land, all with their own homes. Like, this is not, you know, stuff that comes into the view. I, you know, one thing that I've been very moved by is how respectful that this community has been in this process, even through their anger. They're very, you know, and North Carolina, this part of North Carolina is this way. They're very genteel, and you know, it's moving to watch people's hearts breaking and to still watch them have love and respect. And you know, even affection at some points for people they consider to be their enemies in this. That to me, I think, I mean, it was a joy, but it also made it really difficult because it's so real. You know, it's not just sort of, they're not motivated by anger. They're really motivated by belief. So that's them.
I have one, sorry, I'm sorry to jump in, Jason, but I have one question based on what you just last said. Just as, you know, a local, I'm a northerner, I'm from Chicago. We tend to be pretty nice in the Midwest, but we're not like, we don't really talk around things necessarily. You know, we're somewhat more direct. And I feel like there was some dust up recently, like with Dixie Twitter and Yankee Twitter, like fighting. And it was like, in the South, we just don't do that. Like, it's just so offensive to just like speak so plainly like that, and to be so offensive and to just insult like that. Like, you know, you kind of have to talk around things, and like you need to give people time, and you need to, like, if you, I don't know what it was, but there's all these theories then flying around as to like why the South is this way, and like, is it the Civil War? Is it what? So, anyways, I'm just wondering, as a Southerner, what's your take on this, like, genteel culture?
That's a great question. So the Appalachian South's very different than the, like, you know, broader
The
South.
rest of it, yeah.
Yeah, but I would say, I mean, like, and the difference is there. I think Appalachian people are extremely accommodating and self-deprecating, but they have a little bit of fire, and if you take them there, they'll go there.
So you are almost like, I mean, somewhat out of your element. Like, come on, like, let's fight. Like, let's do this
I,
thing.
in a way, you know, I think some of it is there's a part of me that thinks it's almost maturity, because you know, My mama used to have a saying, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. And
Yeah.
I she made a joke. I deleted it, but I made a joke on Twitter the other day that was like, sometimes I don't want to catch the flies. I want to set them on fire.
I love it. Oh my God, that's so me.
But I also, I mean, I do think that, just as a mode of communicating, if you can sort of if you can get people to open up to you and relate to you, then you can usually get, help them to see your perspective.
Right.
In the case of these folks in North Carolina, I don't think that they've been successful in doing that with Piedmont. I mean, I actually some of the things that Piedmont has said about, folks being unreasonable or folks, this, that, or the other, I don't think that they are at all convinced, and I don't think that they are, other than the business consequences, sincerely regretful for not communicating with folks as they maybe should have. I do think the board of supervisors is very moved by the style of communication, because again, to them, these are people, this is the Bible Belt. They have sort of like, shared beliefs, shared culture. In many cases, shared community. These are folks who know each other. They're friendly. They grew up together. And I think that that's really been significant. I think it's been important, just that style of communication. On the other hand, they have not, and I think that this is something that I've seen in Appalachia, although I'm seeing a little bit of an evolution. They've not shied away from the fight. Like, they have said, this is what this will cost me. This is what this will mean to me. This is what we're doing. This is how you're not being truthful. They've been very direct in their opposition and their criticism of the project and the approach to the project.
I'm curious your take, Baron, because you live a bit north in from me in Southwest Virginia. I mean, in Western North Carolina, up in the mountains, there's not really many natural resources to mine or extract, but we're talking about kind of the difficulties people are having. A big part of it is like land speculation, right? There's not much to get out of the ground, but there are beautiful views. There's a lot of people who are buying up their second or third home, snowbirds, who stay for maybe a week or a month at a time, raising the land and housing prices, raising property taxes. Is it similar? I'm curious where you are. What's that like? What's the and I consider that kind of an extractive economy, just conceptualized a little bit differently, but it's still kind of bleeding people dry, the locals dry in many ways. I'm curious, like where you live, is what is that kind of dynamic? What is the extractive economy that you're dealing with?
A lot
Please.
of different ones.
Yeah.
We don't we're not in a desirable location. And so, I mean, that's just sort of the blunt truth. I mean, to us, it's heaven, but it's not near an interstate. It's very difficult to get there from anywhere. There are beautiful views, but there are also places that have been strip mined and where mountaintops have been removed to build other projects, or I was thinking about this actually today. There are ways in which we have not, over the years, expressed gratitude for what we've had through action. That's the way that I'll put it. I do over in Abingdon, Virginia, which is not really, it's been sort of a commerce center. There are a lot of professional services, folks who work in professional services there. That's been a bigger issue. I think, Damascus, which is actually, I don't think, too far from you.
Yeah, I drove. I just wanted to check out Abington one day, but I took my one of my kids, both my kids are one. I don't remember, but I went through Damascus, and I wasn't expecting anything. I hadn't heard of Damascus, and I was just like, this place is beautiful. Like, how have I not heard of this? I got to Abington, and I was like, yeah, Abington's all right, but
Yeah,
Damascus.
exactly. That's how I feel about it
Yeah.
too. We know where the real gold is.
Right. And it's only like an hour and a half away from me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's stunning. But I where we are, the issue, I mean, there's sort of like two local issues brewing. One is in Russell County. That's a proposed private landfill on a reclaimed mine site, the old Moss mine site. It's been really, I've followed it pretty closely. I have been to, community meetings about it, county board meetings about it. I'm in it. But it's really interesting because the place where they would build that is in Cleveland, Virginia, which is a community that has, a really, really small population. It's a really beautiful place. But it's not a place where there are a lot of people who are even really able to fight back. Although I don't want to diminish their effort at all. I mean, people who can certainly are. And there's been a, I think, pretty bipartisan effort that's been organic across the county to really push back against the project. It's interesting because these projects are really all tied to coal in some way or another. So, in this case, the project, the guy who owns the company who's advancing the project, what is a former coal baron. And so, this and another project that's in motion in Wise County, where I am, they're sort of almost these guys who earned money in the coal fields and are like, okay, what else can we do with this? The big issue there is that Bristol nearby had a quarry landfill that was just an absolute disaster, because it was a limestone quarry. It was basically like eating through the lining of the landfill. It had to be replaced every couple of years. It turned into like a major nuisance in terms of odor. It really has turned into an environmental hazard. It had to be shut down. It was a major sort of debacle between Bristol, Virginia and Bristol, Tennessee. Bristol's really two cities. There are these tensions there. And now not only is the city, it's city-owned landfill, so not only is the city not able to take trash and earn any income from that, but it's facing millions of dollars in remediation costs. So it's basically a like cautionary tale next door that people are like, hell no, like we do not want this thing. We don't want to take trash from other places. In this case, the proposal is to train in trash from other states. And it's just not what folks want. So there's that. And then the other proposal is basically a new energy research park on land that's owned, and I'm not gonna remember the name of the company, but by an oil and gas company in Texas. It's all formerly mine land or for land formerly owned by mines. It's really kind of, what it would involve could be small module nuclear reactors, could be wind, could be solar, could be, any number of things. Certainly it will involve data centers because we are in love with data centers in my county. That's all we want to do. But the land mass is a quarter of the land mass in the county. So it would be, if they move forward with the project, it'd be a massive undertaking. And my concern is really, again, the kind of experimental nature of the thing. On the one hand, on the other hand, these are formerly mined lands, or again, land formerly owned by mines. But they're not ugly. We're not talking about stuff that was mined yesterday. We're talking about stuff that was mined decades ago. So, the idea is that these are lands that are being, quote unquote, improved. And Jason, you and I have talked about this before, but they're not being improved. There's not a there's not a lavender farm. It's
Right.
like, improve the land by exploiting it further. Like, how can we do this? So, those are the sort of like two major things that are under consideration. The difficulty, of course, is again, like, these are not big job creators. Yeah, they might create some jobs, but they're not going to create jobs on the scale that coal did. And so, even that part of it, which is kind of a, we may not love it, but we'll hold our nose for the sort of broader public benefit, it lacks that element. So, that's difficult.
Right. There doesn't seem much upside for the locals. There's profit to be made, but not by them for the most part.
That's right.
I would just say, just listening to you talk this past little bit, like I'm just, it sounds to me so much like this kind of small is beautiful, like old left kind of reverence for local culture and like landed communities. I don't know where that went, or if it like went underground, or it just like isn't as vocal as it was before. And like, this is what. Like Kingsnorth wrote this whole book, Paul Kingsnorth, called Real England, which I just found out about. And now I'm like, now I want to go back and read it, because it's like, the little small communities and culture of England, and like the small town and rural England that are we're getting encroached upon by globalization. Like, he first did like a whole anti-globalization book, and then he did this Real England book. And I'm just like, to me, this is the total future, is like the renaissance of this like world of imbued with culture, meaning like history, lineage, ancestry, stories, where it's like, who do we come from, and what, like, who are we looking to for to lead us, historically or via stories. And so I'm just wondering now if we want to turn a little bit more explicitly towards the optimism, and like get the Farron, optimism future. I don't know. The wild crafting story is really amazing in this, like, and having some vision. I don't know if you want to talk at all about like the sorghum molasses story, like just like, what is the vision? We're not, of course, not going to return to some past, but there is still like, it's not all lost. Globalization hasn't totally homogenized every aspect of culture. There's plenty of culture that still exists. Like, so what, what should we be looking toward? What are you excited about? What's your vision?
That's a good question. I think this might make me emotional. I hope it doesn't.
I hope it does.
We'll see what happens.
It'll make for great content if it does.
No, actually, I was driving around today, and I was looking, for your reference, I'm actually in North Carolina right now, where my dad's family is from, and that I've, I wrote a little bit about, in the lithium piece. And I, there's this guy with a garden, and he's an older man, and I have watched him my whole life since, I was a little girl, and we would come down here, and he had this beautiful garden. And I was here a few weeks ago, and I started watching him. I can see him like start preparing it. And if you're out early enough, you can watch him watch his garden. And he's so proud of it, and he should be proud of it, because it's stunning. Like, it's the most beautiful garden that I think I've ever seen. And you can go a couple of streets down, and there's a guy who has bees, and he's the same way with his bees. It's like this tenderness and this affection, and this sort of like slow, patient approach to what he's doing and what's important to him. And I really think that patience is optimistic. And we might not be seeing culture shift in any kind of revolutionary way back toward small pleasures, but we are seeing some people shift back toward that. And we are seeing pockets of community shift back toward that. And I think that there's movement to be made on the margins. I did hear, and this is a sprinkle of pessimism in my optimism, but I had never heard somebody like, I knew that people generally believe that like most of their possessions were disposable. I'd never heard somebody actually say that till like, okay. And I was like, oh no, my mind is blown. You're embracing this as a positive. That's not good. But even looking to, and these are sort of, they seem like very superficial trends. I don't think they are. People, young people thrifting, young people turning away from sort of fast fashion or mass manufactured goods. There's a movement toward there's a huge maker culture that's interested in sort of quilting and woodworking and all kinds of crafts. And I think we have this mentality that, oh, that's just for Etsy and it's all part of this, but it's not, right? Like it is this return to kind of like tactile experiences. And when you give gifts, you're giving not just objects but time. I think that's very optimistic. And I do think, as stories go, we are finding and we have been finding ways to tell these stories. I think, Twitter, of course, can be one aspect of that, but I think that, County Highway is seeing all kinds of other little, more localized, sort of versions of itself pop up. And to me, that's really, really important. Like, do we know about the ground that's under us? Like, do we know about the people who lived here? And ways that they're connected to the land and the ways that we can carry on that connection. I do feel optimistic about that. I mean, I think industries are making stuff, and I think people are making art and culture. And yeah, that means a lot to me and makes me joyful.
I mean, I would just say just briefly from my experience, like I've really tried, like it was very easy for me. I just moved back to Chicago from 7 years in Uruguay in South America, and it was very easy for me to see the optimism in my community in Uruguay. Like, it's just like there's so much co social cohesion, like everybody's got a land-based activity, and then it's very modern, but still like like this connection to earth and the environment, all this. But I'm starting now to try to see Chicago with new eyes, and there's a lot going on under the surface that I kind of, I think, pessimistically or like doomeristically kind of wrote off. And just the other day, just last night, like my daughters were running across the street to the neighbor girl's house and jumping on their trampoline, and I could hear them out the door, and kids running to each other's like front door and ringing the bell. I think the bell rang. It was probably a kid coming to play with my kids who are not home, and like I love that. And I just didn't see it before. I think probably because I was a young adult and not had didn't have like kids yet of like this age, so where they can kind of run together. But like I think a lot, at least our generation now, there's a huge contingent of people who like want their kids to be raised that way. They want neighborliness. They want to like get together. My next door neighbor like want to put a flyer in everybody's door and was like, we should get together. We shouldn't just have a block party. We should have a party like every season where we can get together and roast s'mores and like, do an Easter egg hunt or whatever. And I just think like it feels to me, and I have no idea if this is because of my life course, how old I am, like the period I am in life, but like it feels to me people are wanting, craving that aliveness, like that connection, the meaning, and in ways that like doesn't detract or require any like extreme buy-in, like an intentional community or anything utopian. Like they really are just like seeking this kind of like what they experienced forms of connection, and like are just over the safetyism and over the alienation. Like we're done with that now. So I don't know. I'm just finding those people and feeling very hopeful about it.
I love how you said that. Just the aliveness. Like that's what it feels, right? Like that's what it feels like. If you make a connection with somebody who maybe you didn't think you would make a connection with. Like you have a moment where you're like, oh my gosh, I think I love you. Totally different from you with a different background and different perspective, but you can share what's human, and that is so beautifully optimistic. I love that so much.
All right, Jason, sorry, we're hogging the conversation. You can.
No, I just want to say that you're describing in on Twitter the last few weeks of this neighborhood stuff coming together. I'm very envious. I posted this a little bit on Twitter, but so like we have a house going up for sale near us.
The
Good
following
two bedroom,
list.
two bath, not big house, has some land, it's on 4 acres. And we have two sets of friends with kids that would love to buy that house, and we would love to like all live next to each other, and they're probably not going to be able to afford it because land prices have just gone insane over here. And this is one of those places where there is also a lot of craft culture, but it doesn't seem to be at the point yet where it can be a real craft culture versus kind of people sell at the fair and the Floridians come in and think it's cute and buy it.
Yeah, right.
That I'm not knocking that. Like that's my wife is starting to sell at markets or pottery, and she sells to these high-end clientele. But to actually have people living connected, I mean, there is some of that because I think there's a lot of like more niches, right? The haulers where you still have these like family compounds and stuff. But yeah, I'm feeling a little wistful of a potential future for our family where there is more of a community, because otherwise there's like four houses nearby. One of them is empty most of the time. It's completely empty. Another one's being used for an Airbnb, and I'm worried that this house is going to be bought up by an investor for Airbnb. And it's just going to be it's beautiful location, there's land, but it's just going to be desolate.
With no one alive actually living there.
No,
It's just
duh, right? We're just gonna
this,
have to be
yeah, I
alive
mean, we're
ourselves
all
on our own.
we are all on the short end of the global economy, that is for sure. Like there is no, there's no running away from it. And even in Uruguay, I mean, there's no running away from it. We're all subject to the pressures of all of this. But I hope, I hope, Jason, that you're, especially as your kids get a little bit older and there's school and sports and activities, even if they're not proximate neighbors, you'll find your, close families and networks and that kind of thing. But it does still just having people, one of the houses around you as a regular Airbnb is horrible hollowing out down by Silicon Valley.
I see this almost as a, I mean, I totally understand what you're saying, and I connect with it. I connect with it in a kind of a different way because where I am, I feel like people, there's so many empty houses and that have just been left to fall in on themselves and go on. It's almost an equal opposite problem where, there is this hollowing out of the community itself, and there's either nothing or there's transience, and that cannot be, sort of the foundation for a community. And that hurts my heart, Jason.
Well, I'm holding out hope.
Those people, get them out of
Yeah,
there.
we're trying to use some back channels, like call the lawyers, and going underneath the real estate market and see if we can pull something off. So not all hope is lost yet. This is
I hope, I think. I hope it works out. I actually have heard in the last little bit some encouraging stories in this kind of space where you're struggling, where folks understand market challenges and are going directly to potential buyers and saying hey, I know I might not make as much money. It doesn't matter to me. I don't want to sell to them. I'd like to sell to you. That's really encouraging to me because I feel like there's this awareness and this connectedness that's like, hey, human. The human.
I mean, that's definitely, I don't know if it's illegal to do, but in my neighborhood, there people will try to sell to buyers who are either not just necessarily from the neighborhood, but aren't just flipping the house to make a profit, or aren't just going to be renting it out or making an Airbnb or whatever, So, no, I think that's, there's some fight left.
Might have some
Okay,
insight
so.
into this, Farron, because the sellers is so she trusted it to her Baptist church, and I think it's a larger Baptist organization. I don't know. I don't know if you have special insight into kind of Baptist church culture.
Have you chatted with them at all?
I mean, I know I've chatted with some of the family, and I think they're kind of like it's not in our domain. One of the families who's interested, like they've lived here for quite a while, and they're kind of more local, definitely more locals than we are. And I think they're going to try and make that case that, hey, like we're, family, kid, the daughter, we want to use this land well. They're going to try and make that kind of case. But, I'm sure the church has other considerations, for itself as well.
I think, I mean, they certainly should try to make that case because, I can't know that church's circumstances, but as a Baptist, I
Put in a couple, Baron.
do, I mean, at least in the tradition that I grew up in, community is very important, and actually I was thinking about this today, and I feel like I mention neighbor in every story that I write and everything that I do. I'm like neighbor, neighbor. But part of that is just because of the teachings of the Baptist Church that if you don't love your neighbor, you don't love God. I mean, that's the position, is that you cannot hate your brother and love God. So I think that there's a theological case to be made.
Can you sell to an investor who will Airbnb
Yeah, right.
it and love
Right,
But
so
I
final.
want to ask one more question.
Oh,
I
sorry,
think
go ahead.
are you kind of wrapping up, actually?
Yeah, I was just gonna say final thoughts, but yeah, go
It's
ask another
one kind of smallish question. When you're thinking about stories, so we talked about like you're doing these stories about kind of the material extractivist economy and the affected communities, and you're doing these stories on things you find very hopeful about people recovering the tactile meaningness of life. How do you decide, like, to put it, very crassly, like the ratio of how you spend your time and in reporting? Like what? How do you think about, okay, we have to defend, there's certain things we have to defend, but there's also certain things, we have to cultivate, and how do you find that balance?
I don't.
Yeah.
That's a great question. I feel like I need to make notes.
Like I should be doing
Structured time. I think, I mean, just speaking totally vulnerably and frankly, there are things that are very precious to me that I've wanted to protect and that I've wanted to share with other people. And there are things that I hear about that I feel affected by, and that I feel, frankly, hurt by, because I can understand what that community is going through, and what their hopes and really their deep fears are. And so I sometimes I don't know, I don't I feel like I don't know what the story is going to be until it's already finished, which my editor is like, no, that is not the way.
Yeah.
But I do think, I think there's a lot of, on the one hand, there's a lot of sort of exploitation even in writing. We talked about this before, Jason, of Appalachian culture, especially now. I think this is trending off a little bit now, but for there were a couple of years in there where people were obsessed with everything Appalachian and putting up TikTok videos about accents and little sayings, and it felt so artificial and disingenuous to me that it felt important to put something out that was organic, and that showed people who are real people, who really are the caretakers of the culture. And then on the other hand, I can see people who are really making an effort to do that. Maybe it's not been as important to them in their day-to-day lives as it is, from my uncle, for instance, who is my best friend and hero. But it becomes very important when they realize through, these difficult situations what matters most to them. And so I guess, like, not to be woo-woo about it, but it kind of like shows up for me. Like, this is what you should write about at this time. I do, to your point, after the last couple of stories that I've written, I feel really exhausted. And again, like, I don't have that thing where you can just say, like, okay, I'm bearing witness to this, but I have no connection to it. That's not me, and that's not really who I've become. So, You know, I think I'm gonna turn back to the hopeful. Like, have somebody tell me like really lovely things that have like double spiritual meanings. That's what I hope for.
It's not just a horrible, difficult, Sounds like it's just women's intuition. Yeah, I'm like, I think I might be leaning towards my woo-woo stage more and more. I just like, I'm like, I don't know what doomer optimism is at all. Like, I think it's just love. Like, it's just connection to
Just vibes.
people who love other things that you love. I'm like, I just need to log off now.
Every
Okay. I'm like more and more convinced. Like going so far into nuance that like nothing is just, a barrier anymore, but it's just, Anyways, yeah, this was so, it's a very soulful conversation. I've really enjoyed talking to you both. It's good to host again together, Jason.
Yes.
And I'm so glad you organized this, and were patient with both of our busyness, me and Farron. But yeah, I don't know. Final thoughts. Jason, do you have any final thoughts?
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Farron. I'm sorry for mispronouncing your name at the top. I felt bad about that this whole episode. But I really admire you, and yeah, I'm honored that we can have you on.
Are you all gonna get together in Appalachia for some kind of event ever? I'm just.
I think we should just get together.
Low key.
Okay, something low key. Like, okay. Well, and you guys are all the type of like, let me feel each other out and build some trust before I go into anything that will take like,
Yeah,
my
actually the type who's
time.
like let's get a 100-person conference together,
No, never 100%,
Okay.
always 50 and under. Although, well, actually, you know what? Maybe it'll be 100 the next one, but I just am like, everyone is so beautiful. I just can't wait to meet you and like,
Yeah.
but the Appalachians, all
And
the
I'm like, I
Southern.
just don't I don't want to leave the county.
Yeah, that's basically all of you. You cannot make events with you people.
I know we live like two or three counties away, and it's like
That's so far.
like two or three countries away.
Amazed my mom, and I don't want to interrupt, but very, very quick story. My uncle just got some bays, and he got bays because some bays were in my other uncle's wall. So he came, got the bays out. He is like super excited about them. He doesn't have all the supplies he needs. Nobody in my family uses the internet. So they came to
I love
me
this.
and they were like, Farron, like, find us a place. I found a place in Hayside, Virginia, which is not far. It's not far at all. And my mom was like, well, I'm gonna have to see. Like, if he might not want to go over there if he's not familiar with
Oh my God. I love it. I love it. I'm just loving provincialism more and more.
He did, though. Happy
Oh,
ending.
good. Good. For a good purpose. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for organizing this, Jason. I'm sure it's, we'll be talking to you again at some point in the future. Or in person, not recorded.
Yes, I hope so. Thank you all so much for having me. I also very quickly just want to echo what you said, Jason. Like, it is so satisfying to spend time with y'all. And I care about you and I'm grateful to you and I'm always learning from you and I'm just super appreciative.
Aw, this is the best. I'm so glad we have a podcast. We get to meet fun people, Jason.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's really it. We wouldn't meet people like you if it wasn't for the podcast. So
Aw. All right, I gotta go.
now we have to hang out sometime.
Yeah,
Yeah.
you
Well, I promise.
guys should at least need to hang out, but Farron, you need to come to one of my events in this fall. So
I would love to. I would love to. All
okay.
right.
All right, I'm gonna go.
Cool.
Bye.
Bye.